The attorney for Freddie Gray's family urges black law students to be strong advocates for the black community. Also, should the United Nations pressure the U.S. about terrorist attacks against African Americans? Coming up next. Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition for July 2, 2015 on 89.3 WPFW, your Pacifica listener-powered station for jazz and justice in the nation's capital. On the Ground and onthegroundshow.org is devoted to coverage of social justice activists and activism. I'm Esther Rivera. Well, the work of Black Lives Matter activists has highlighted the key role of legal advocacy to protect and maintain human rights. And an important institution preparing particularly aspiring black attorneys for social justice advocacy exists right here in D.C. The Charles Hamilton Houston Law School Preparatory Program, in its 36th year, held its annual memorial lecture this week featuring the attorney William H. Murphy, known as Billy Murphy, a former judge on the Circuit Court for Baltimore City. Murphy is founder and senior partner of Murphy, Falcon & Murphy, where he is representing the family of Freddie Gray, who died in April after being injured while in custody of the Baltimore Police Department. And, of course, Gray's injuries and death led to an uprising in the city, as well as acts of looting and arson. We'll bring you a portion of Murphy's remarks delivered Tuesday night to aspiring black attorneys. In the second half of the show, we'll be speaking with prolific author and activist Gerald Horn about if and how the case of African Americans needs to be brought to the United Nations. So, as always, we have a lot for you in this less than an hour, starting with this week's activism headlines. More than $120,000 has been raised for the legal defense and assistance for Bree Newsom, who climbed a flagpole on the grounds of the South Carolina State Capitol and removed the controversial Confederate flag. Accompanied by fellow human rights activists from the organization The Tribe, Newsom quoted scriptures while willingly being arrested after the successful action.
You come against me with hatred and oppression and violence. I come against you in the name of God. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid?
I'm trying to come down, sir.
I'm going to comply. I promise you.
I'm coming down. I'm prepared to be arrested.
On this Saturday, July 5th, at 5 p.m., The Actor, a continuing talk on race series, will feature a talk by Dr. Francis Cress Welsing on what is race at the 14th and V Busboys and Poets. For more information, go to the Busboys and Poets website. And the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities is circulating a letter to be signed by national organizations by next Tuesday, July 7th at noon, to ensure that the expiring provisions of the Child Tax Credit and the Earned Income Tax Credit are included in any Senate action on taxes. The center says that consequences for minimum wage earning parents and their children and for millions of other low-income families are huge. They say that the tax breaks, known as the EITC and the CTC, are among the nation's strongest tools to help working families escape poverty and achieve greater self-sufficiency. Together, they lifted 9.4 million people out of poverty and made 22 million others less poor in 2013. They also lift 5 million children out of poverty. More information is at cbpp.org. And of course, since we were here last week, the Supreme Court handed down the historic ruling legalizing same-sex marriage in all 50 states, upheld key provisions of both the Affordable Care Act and laws to prevent housing discrimination. More on these issues will be covered, as well as the controversial fight against the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty, in the second half of the show. And in our culture and media moment, the Capitol Fringe Festival is getting underway next Thursday, July 9th, with theater, dance, music, visual art, and everything in between. The venues include traditional theaters, corner bars, and vacant storefronts. You can get more information at capitalfringe.org. And those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, attorney William Billy Murphy, former judge of the Circuit Court for Baltimore City, who is representing the family of Freddie Gray. Stay with us. Welcome back to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Rivera. Turning now to the key role of legal advocacy to protect and maintain human rights. And an important institution preparing particularly aspiring black attorneys for law school and for social justice advocacy exists right here in D.C. The Charles Hamilton Houston Law School Preparatory Program, in its 36th year, held its annual memorial lecture this week featuring William H. Murphy, known as Billy Murphy, a former judge on the Circuit Court for Baltimore City. Murphy is founder and senior partner of Murphy, Falcon & Murphy, where he is representing the family of Freddie Gray, who died in April after being injured while in custody of the Baltimore police. And, of course, his injuries and death led to an uprising in the city, as well as acts of looting and arson. Here is Billy Murphy delivering the Charles Hamilton Houston Memorial Lecture at the Georgetown University Law School in Northwest D.C. Here are a portion of his remarks.
Before I begin, I want to humbly thank God Almighty for landing me in the family of Bill and Madeline Murphy. I know there's God because that was such a wonderful thing for me. And I had no role in that. It was a blessing. You know, many people come out of the black community and they want to be black leaders. There's a place for that. But very few of us want to be world leaders. Very few of us want to be leaders. We always put the word black in front of it, recognizing that although we need to be of service to our own community, we are of maximal service when we serve everybody, because the more truth we lay out about the human condition, the better off all black people will be. And, you know, Ben Mays used to open up in his introductory lecture at Morehouse, to the Morehouse men, by quoting the poet John Donne, who said, "Failure is not sin, but low aim." And we ought to paste that on our mirrors. Failure is not sin, but low aim. I'll get back to that in a minute, because that's going to be the jumping off point for my remarks. And I want to go back and talk about my family. I'll wrap it up very simply by saying 95% of the good in me is because of them. 95% of whatever you see that is good, wonderful, nice, kind, it came from them. We are so malleable that we underestimate, as second-class citizens, with the burdens of a subconscious programming that slavery created. We underestimate how important family is and how that malleability can become twisted in the service of evil. How high aim, the natural state of a child, can become low aim. How high intelligence through the remarkable ability of psychology can become low intelligence, have great and good feelings towards one another, love. The love energy can become warped very easily into hate. And we're living proof of both extremes. I didn't want to start off by talking about the state of the black community. I wanted to first thank God for my family. But I want to thank God for Donald Temple, too. You know, Donald's a remarkable man. I've known Donald since he was a law student, that is true. But that was so far ago that the difference in our ages doesn't matter anymore. We're just colleagues. We look eye to eye. We don't look up or we don't look down at each other. We just look at each other. And I have so much respect for Donald because Donald is what we all strive to be. He's a giver. There are only two kinds of people in the world, the givers and the takers. They're easy to identify. They are both consistent in their behavior. They don't cross a line and become givers after a lifetime of taking. And they don't become takers if they've ever experienced the joy of giving. And so Donald is an icon to me. Donald exemplifies the major virtue lawyers must have. And what is that? What is the major virtue a lawyer must have? It's not rhetorical. I want an answer from some of you. Okay, you said?
Selflessness.
Selflessness. Who said compassion? Okay, they're related. What else? Integrity, somebody said. Right? What else?
Love.
Well, love is very close. What I'm talking about is a subspecies of love.
Passion.
Passion. Okay. I like passion, but that's not the one I'm looking for. Empathy. You know, these are all good things. I'm going to give you my top number one. Because none of these things can happen if you don't have this. It's a necessary, albeit insufficient, condition. Courage. You cannot have principles without courage. Every day, in some way or another, you get tried where you have to choose between a principled act and something else. Greatness comes from a commitment to principle. And you cannot have principles without courage. The worst thing that you can do when you're representing someone else's vital interests is be a punk. And I deviate from the high to the low. You know, you gotta forgive me for this. A punk is so easy to identify. And black men, hear me. White men of power can smell a punk a mile away. You just give off a different odor. And they're going to treat you like a punk. And there are so many black punks today, more than I've ever seen in my history on the planet. And unfortunately, the percentage of black punks in law school seems to be on the rise. And, you know, being a punk is the lowest state of being. Especially if you undertake to serve others. Punks don't do a good job of serving. They don't have the courage to talk back to power. And our major role as lawyers is to talk back to power. Tell the truth to power. Punks can't do that. Punks end up in major roles, black punks, in establishing policy that the white, courageous and wealthy and powerful apply to us. We call them ratifiers. You get one on your jury, he's going to go along with the white folks. Now look, when I talk about white and black, let's don't be stupid about it. I'm not talking about all white people. Every time I give a talk where race is implicated, somebody's feelings get hurt because they think I'm necessarily talking about them. I'm not. Everybody is an individual who stands on his own or her own. I can't speak for every individual in a group, but I can tell you about group tendencies. I can tell you about what groups do. I can tell you about group attitudes. Now, if you don't happen to fall into this category, don't get pissed off because I'm saying something that you don't like about your mother or your brother or your colleague or people that you admire. Suck it up. Don't be a punk. Have the courage to look at yourself when you hear me talk. If what I say applies to you, eat it. Deal with it. If it doesn't, help others to overcome the problem. Now, getting back to courage and the state of the black community. Let's face it, we've had a failure of black leadership. We just have. You know, when I was coming up in the 60s, and I know you all hate to hear older black people talk about the 60s like it's experiencing the 60s is an eligibility to real blackness. No. I went through the 60s. It was the greatest period of our history. Too bad that you all haven't seen a similar epoch or epoch. But that's the truth of the matter. When you looked at the national landscape and give it some thought, those of us who came up during that time could identify at least 30 nationally renowned black leaders of courage. They were fighting a good fight. They had a national profile because they had earned it. They were a part of the struggle. And the second thing that you would know about these guys is that they didn't always get along. This whole black unity thing is oversold. We don't need unity of ideas. We need unity of purpose. Unity of purpose keeps you under the umbrella of community. Unity of ideas is to be despised. Why should it be despised? Because, like we say, black lives matter, great ideas matter, and they come from unpredictable sources. And we always have to check our egos at the door in the service of a better idea. Mm-hmm. If we have phony unity, we are no longer interested in coming up with the best ideas, because the best ideas will cause controversy. They will cause jealousy. They will cause egos to be ruffled. They will cause disunity, sometimes permanently, sometimes, most often, temporarily. They will be blows against those with inferior ideas until they open their minds and adopt them to become bomb. So, phony unity is to be despised. So look at the national landscape today. Back in the 60s, 30, 40, easily identifiable black leaders, all with a particular set of ideas coming from their own experiences and their own different views of the future. Lots of arguments. Let me give you an example. Malcolm X, my hero, versus Martin Luther King, my hero. I was a Malcolm guy through and through. Still am. But I became a King guy when I started to grow up. Pick one over the other, like we did when we were juveniles? No. They both played a major role. And by the way, Malcolm X was a lawyer at heart because he was the most prepared person I ever knew. He anticipated every question white people would ask about the movement, every disparaging strategy, and he had a 4x6 file card, stacks of them, with the one sentence, refined, killer answer. You know, it's like preparing for oral argument. You got to anticipate everything that the judges may ask. And you have to be so well prepared that when they come at you, you got that one sentence, killer answer. Well, that was Malcolm X. Martin Luther King, spiritually oriented. In service of a higher level of being. Nonviolent. Understood the value of nonviolence. Had a worldwide impact. And when he became a world leader, and that was when he came out against the Vietnam War. You know, that was a white folks' war, you know? I mean, it was white folks fighting against each other about what the policy should be. Black folks were irrelevant to Vietnam until Dr. King, using the platform that he had gained, injected himself on a moral level. Then things changed. That's why he was killed. He'd become extraordinarily influential over all people, not just black people. Malcolm X became influential as a world leader when he started putting the dots together in the Pan-Africa movement. And he started traveling abroad, contrary to the wishes of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, another hero of mine. And when he discovered the world, and he started integrating into the world. And when he went to the conference at Bandung and got involved with the OAU, Organization of African Unity, and he started rallying African leaders to file with him a petition against the United States for violating the human rights of black people. Not the civil rights, the human rights of black people. And that leadership caused traction, and the leaders of Africa got together and actually started working on a petition to the UN. That's why he was killed. World leadership, power, high goal. Let's go back to the state of the black community for a minute. Never been worse. Not just because we got punks. And, you know, punkdom comes from something we all suffer from. It's called ignorance. Mm-hmm. A punk is a person ignorant of the power of his being. Mm-hmm. A punk has low aim. A punk always wants someone to bow down to. A punk is not an initiator. He's a follower. He traffics in other people's ideas, concepts, timing, situations. He's a tool. He's like a hammer or a screwdriver. He's a punk. The person using the hammer, to use the words of Theodore Roosevelt, you know, it's not the critic who counts, it's the man or the woman in the arena who is fighting the good fight, who knows blood, sweat, and tears, who has succeeded and failed, but when he failed greatly. He failed doing something that was great. The punks are on the sidelines, hoping that the great man falls. Mm-hmm. You can spot them. You know them. There may be some in this room. And I'm really talking to them. Courage is the key thing. So let's look at the black community. Why are we in our city? Why are there so many Freddie Gray? Why is this an intractable problem that we have not solved? We, the small W, us. We, the large W, everyone. Why have we failed so miserably to get rid of the hangover of chattel slavery that infected the subconscious and conscious minds of everybody on the planet especially here when it comes to us, still affects us, including that 100-year period afterwards. What is it now, close to 150 years? Slavery started 1619, officially ended 1865, unofficially didn't end until the Civil Rights Movement. I was 21 when the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed. And I share Donald's view. I still don't have my rights. You know, whenever there's a white cop or a black wannabe imitator, I don't have my rights. And they're all over the country, right? So let's talk about that. So why is it that Freddie Gray died? Why is it that the Freddie Grays of the United States died? Because of our history. You know, white folks will always try to put you on the defensive. What's slavery got to do with it? Everything. That's the answer. And when they challenge you on it, have a list of books for them to read and say, you know, I would love to have this conversation with you, but first you've got to know the real history of this country.
If you're just tuning in, this is Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition on 89.3 WPFW in Washington. And you've been listening to the voice of attorney Billy Murphy, former judge on the Circuit Court for Baltimore City. Murphy is founder and senior partner of Murphy, Falcon & Murphy, where he is representing the family of Freddie Gray, who died in April after being injured while in police custody. Well, after the break, it's your turn. We'll be talking to author, activist, and professor Gerald Horn about if and how the United Nations can pressure the U.S. about terrorism against the African-American community. And you can join the discussion by calling 202-588-0893. We'll be right back. And it's also your turn, those who are listening. You can join the discussion by calling 202-588-0893. And you might also want to comment on the remarks we played by attorney Billy Murphy this week when he urged aspiring black attorneys to step up to the plate of social justice and go to work on our behalf and not be what he called a punk. Okay, so Gerald, why do you think that it's an important move right now for our case to be taken to the UN?
Well, to answer that question, let me first go on a brief historical excursion. We know that a few days from now, the United States will be marking its so-called national holiday, July 4th, 1776, the revolt against British rule. And as you know, I wrote this book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the USA, where I argued that the Africans, for the most part, opposed the secession from the British Empire, just like the Africans in Dixie in 1861 supposed the secession from the United States of America, with both forms of opposition based upon this idea that the secession was based in no small measure on solidifying our oppression. And so in order to explain how we got to where we are today in 2015, you have to understand that what we did historically was seek leverage in the international community in order to countervail and counterbalance the reactionary forces that hold so much sway and influence in these United States of America. So therefore, Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist leader, who I'm sure many WPFW programmers will reclaim his famous July 4th, 1852 speech excoriating the founding of the United States, Frederick Douglass spent more time in London, say, than Paul Robeson, the great 20th century leader, spent in Moscow. even though London was probably a bigger foe of the United States as Moscow was in the 20th century. If you look at the Pan-Africanist movement, which has been identified with W.E.B. Du Bois, you may know that that movement was in no small part an attempt to develop an international movement of people of African descent beyond the borders of the United States. I'm publishing a book next year on the relationship between black nationalists and Japan, pointing out how that particular tendency also sought leverage to use against Washington. And certainly we know that a turning point in the struggle against Jim Crow came in 1950 when Paul Robeson and the Civil Rights Congress filed a petition at the United Nations charging the United States with genocide against people of African descent. That particular petition then was echoed by Malcolm X just before he died. The National Black United Front, which will be holding a convention in Houston rather shortly, filed what is called a 1503 petition with the human rights authorities in Geneva, Switzerland. The problem is that many of our leadership would see it as inappropriate to go to the United Nations, because basically what that does is reduce the sovereignty of the government in Washington. It says that you basically have no confidence of the government in Washington, which I think is a fair judgment at this late date. Right. And so it seems to me that if going to the United Nations is going to be a profitable exercise, it's going to have to be done by a number of grassroots organizations, a number of church denominations, and the like. In order to follow up, those within range of my voice should just put in the search engine 1503 United Nations Geneva, and you'll see the complaint form. You'll see the messes tended to downplay it, just like the FBI has been saying they don't find any sign of arson in the recent church burning in South Carolina. We have to recognize that this is not a magic bullet, but it is a powerful tool in our toolkit that has served us well. That is to say, international publicity, international solidarity, putting pressure on the U.S. authorities, because unless pressure is placed upon them, they will inevitably lean to the right against our interests.
I know you're probably aware of the group, kind of grassroots activists in Cleveland, who brought, I want to call it a similar type of action from the community in the case of Tamir Rice, and asking a judge to decide whether he thought that the officers involved in killing the 12-year-old should be charged. And it made the headlines for a few days, and it's kind of faded from attention. So would this be something similar but on an international level?
Well, it's not only Cleveland, but keep in mind that the parents of Michael Brown, the slain teenager in Ferguson, Missouri, were to be found in Geneva in the late fall of 2014. Right. Keep in mind as well that just a few weeks ago in Geneva, there were a number of demands put to the U.S. authorities with regard to the slayings of unarmed black individuals, scores of demands, in fact, and the U.S. authorities are going to have to respond to Geneva by the fall of this year.
Hmm.
I think it would be marvelous when the United Nations General Assembly opens in September 2015 in New York City, if not only were there petitions being filed in Geneva simultaneously, but there would be demonstrators outside, because that's when the world gathers at its annual meeting, and yet we've not been present. It's almost as if the international community can draw the reasonable inference that we don't really have any complaints. We don't really have any demands. And we know that that's not true, but how can we convince the international community otherwise unless we're there in force?
You mentioned, I think, a particular committee underneath the UN. Is that the Human Rights Committee, or what committee would receive this petition?
It's the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. Mm-hmm. And as I said, it's based in Geneva. 1503 is the magic open sesame.
Mm-hmm.
That, if you put that in search engine, you'll see the what would be appropriate to file, how to file. And once again, I think it reminds me of the movement against the South African apartheid. There were those in our movement who said that we should focus solely and exclusively on getting a bill passed through Congress on sanctions. There were others who said, no, we need a decentralized grassroots movement that pressures colleges from the Atlantic to the Pacific, that pressures corporations to the Atlantic to the Pacific with regard to divestment. It turns out we use both strategies, but I think in the long run, it was the latter strategy, this grassroots effort, that basically helped to ensure that sanctions would be passed by Congress. And then President Reagan, you may recall, vetoed sanctions, and then Congress, Republicans included, some Republicans included, helped to overturn that veto, which was quite remarkable. I think today, with the present crisis, we need a similar sort of grassroots movement with church denominations, black organizations of all types, simultaneously in a grassroots effort filing different petitions in Geneva and then gathering at the United Nations in the fall.
Okay. So we have that information. We want to check out 1503 United Nations Geneva on Google, and we'll see the petition right there for any organizations, individuals, groups who want to pursue this path, and we can be at the United Nations in the fall in New York City. So we do have a caller, and if you'd like to also comment, you can call 202-588-0893. 202-588-0893 to join the discussion. So good morning, caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Good morning, Esther. Good morning, Dr. Horn. Tespa, calling from Arlington.
Kind of in the same vein, but kind of I wanted to follow up on something that we played earlier. We played comments from Attorney Billy Murphy, who delivered the Charles Hamilton Houston Memorial Lecture at Georgetown University Law School. He was speaking to aspiring black attorneys, people who had just kind of graduated from school and are preparing to enter law school, and they're in this Charles Hamilton Houston preparatory program to, you know, prepare for law school. And he pointed out that Malcolm X had also, just before he was assassinated, preparing a similar type of move in terms of taking charges, taking the case of African Americans to the UN. Do you want to comment on that or relate what you're saying to that?
Well, first of all, I thought your caller Tesla was going to mention that President Barack Obama would be the first U.S. sitting president to visit Ethiopia within weeks. And I think that many people I've noticed on this program oftentimes call in with complaints about the Ethiopian government. It seems to me that when he shows up in Addis Ababa, that would be a wonderful opportunity to make their grievances known. Now, with regard to Malcolm X, there's no doubt that he was following in a long line of activists who were talking, as my historical excursion suggested, about taking our complaints to the United Nations. Of course, he was struck down before he was able to actualize his own plan in that direction. And I should also say that considering the last 60 years of black American history, we know that there was a blow against apartheid and Jim Crow with Brown versus Board of Education, which is something that I'm sure all of us salute and celebrate. But the price of the ticket, it seems to me, was that we would become like other U.S. nationals. That is to say that we would pay fealty to the government in Washington. Unlike our ancestors, we would reject the internationalizing of our question. We would domesticate our question, and we're still trapped in that domesticated box, but it's obvious that that box is now suffocating and asphyxiating us, and it's time, it's long past time, to break out of that box. But the question is, who is going to do it?
Okay. I think we have one more caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
My name's Austin Floyd, calling from South Carolina.
Welcome. You're on the air.
Okay. My question, I guess two questions. One is, in the previous clip, he mentioned unifying under a specific purpose. But it seems like there's so many different purposes, you know, that many people don't know where to unify from. In the 1960s, the discrimination was right in front of our faces. So now some things are hidden, and sometimes as a younger generation, we don't know completely what to fight for or what to unify around unless it's something public or something that's revealed. So this was the question is, you know, how do you identify the purpose to even unify around it? And then I guess my second question is, and you don't have to answer both of them, taking an issue to the United Nations, I'm not, like, United Nations, they're kind of weak when it comes to...
out of the box of just accepting the narrative of the U.S. media. I mean, for example, President Barack Obama just normalized relations with Cuba. There will be embassies opened in Havana and Washington rather shortly. The whole discourse in the United States of America has totally eluded the essential point from the United States point of view, that this is seen as essential to U.S. national security insofar as in October 1962 there was a so-called Cuban Missile Crisis whereby Moscow placed missiles in Cuba that were seen as a threat to U.S. national security, and the United States almost decided to blow up the world in response. In 2015, there's been a downturn in relations between Moscow and Washington. There have been Russian bomber planes flying off the coast of California through the Gulf of Mexico. There's a new novel out that's becoming a bestseller by Peter Singer called Ghost Fleet that talks about World War III taking place in the Pacific between the United States and China. There are all sorts of Chinese representatives in and out of Moscow. Therefore, as part of Obama's composite calculus, he has decided that it makes good sense from the U.S. national security point of view to normalize relations with Cuba so that Cuba, presumably and hopefully, will not be a base for attack against the United States of America. Now, what I just told you, of course, you will not find in the Washington Post, you will not find in the New York Times, but you'll find it in newspapers abroad. That's the kind of calculus, composite calculus, we need to understand. That is to say, the United States has many enemies, it has many antagonists, its strength is declining worldwide, as anybody who pays attention knows, as the BRICS meeting, which will be taking place rather shortly, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, will also tend to indicate. But if you don't understand this, well, obviously you won't understand the whole question of why you need international pressure. Otherwise, you stay in this domesticated box whereby in 1991, 60% of the Euro-American population in Louisiana voted for a Nazi, David Duke, for governor, where in 2012, 60% of their population voted for a right-winger like Mitt Romney, and will continue to be shot down like wild boar in the streets. Quite frankly, I don't want to go down that pathway.
You know, speaking of your last point, I guess I would answer to Austin that the Black Lives Matter movement has become a rallying point in terms of people organizing to have a purpose, to have a common purpose, and it's a very urgent purpose, and that's, you know, one comment I would give on that. We actually have a few more callers. I'll go to the next caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
I'm RG, calling from Washington, D.C.
Good morning.
And how are you?
Well, fine. You're on the air.
All right. Excellent show this morning. Happy to have heard something from a different viewpoint, particularly a judge, attorney, and jurist to have delivered information to prospective lawyers. To the professor, good morning, Professor Horn. I'd like to ask you from a cogent, rudimentary juristic perspective, one might construe the delivery of the judge to be quite enlightening and even exhilarating. However, from another perspective of social change, there are those casualties throughout our communities over the years from the 60s, as he alluded to in his speech, who feel that some degree of futility in trying to levy social change through the
point by playing it that there is still a need for that, that the Justice Department's report delivered some really important, vital information, you know, from a legal perspective about what happened in Ferguson. And he's just saying that the legal community hasn't always been there for us, and some people have had their legal careers destroyed by trying to fight for the people, basically.
Well, as a lapsed attorney myself, I think I'm qualified to a degree to speak to that question. I think that my generation, which is Billy Murphy's generation, not necessarily Mr. Murphy himself, but many who were part of that generation, in some ways overdetermined the importance of law by basically drawing inappropriate conclusions from Brown versus Board of Education, that anti-Jim Crow decision, drawing inappropriate conclusions from the rise of the Supreme Court led by Earl Warren, which in many ways was a breakaway from the past history of the U.S. Supreme Court, which should be known as the court that gave us Dred Scott, which tried to ratify and solidify slavery. And the Warren Court was an anomaly. It was an anomaly driven in part by international conditions, that is to say, the Cold War causing the United States to try to get its own human rights house in order by so it could better point the finger of accusation at Moscow. And so many of us in that generation thought that we could all be warriors in the court and walk in the footsteps of Thurgood Marshall. And we weren't aware of the historical conditions that had created a Thurgood Marshall. Perhaps that speaks to that caller's point. And on the previous caller, I think in terms of what's unifying us, it's the right to stay alive, the right to escape state-sanctioned violence by the police authorities and individualized violence, so-called, from these terrorists like Dylann Roof in South Carolina. If that doesn't unify us, I don't know what will.
Okay, we have one more caller, and we only have about a minute, but I want to make sure we get you in. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Hi, my name is Biniam. I'm calling from Virginia.
Go ahead, you're on the air.
All right. Very nice show today, but I was just thinking about this whole concept of capitalism working at its full capacity right now. And it's very hard for people to even understand that how much pain they're in because of the relentless bombardment of, you know, ridiculous political story, terrorism around the world.
Right.
And people don't have even a chance to focus on what really right in front of them. And unless something dramatic happens that can capture people's attention.
Okay. And unfortunately, I'm going to have to leave it there, but I get your point and I totally agree. And as a matter of fact, Gerald, I wanted to follow up with you about the TPP because, you know, speaking of capitalism, I wanted to follow up with you about that because since we talked last, the Congress has given the President Obama this fast track authority, but we'll have to follow up the next time we talk. Okay. Yes. Oh, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, and so that will do it for us on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Avarim. Thanks to my guest, Gerald Horn, and also special thanks to Suji Sutler and Donald Temple at the Charles Hamilton Houston Law School Preparatory Program, our engineer, Mike Nasella, and thank you so much for listening, calling in, and supporting your station for Jazz and Justice. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our shows and past shows. If you'd like to work on the show, we have openings for volunteers and interns. Write us at contact@onthegroundshow.org. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Now stay tuned for the news with Askia Muhammad, followed by Krista Property on the Thursday edition of Don't Forget the Blues. Raise your voice out there. Peace.